coming up right now is the Space Show. Welcome to the Space Show, presented by members of the Space Association of Australia. Hello, I am Andrew Rennie. On this evening's The Space Show, Nothing So Hidden, The Voyage of Apollo 16.
Let's take a trip to the moon. Come on, let's go for the moon. Let's take a trip to the moon.
Having emerged victorious in World War II, Americans were shocked when the Soviet Union emerged from the ashes and rubble and, in 1957, launched the world's first artificial Earth satellite, Sputnik 1.
As a result of intensive work by research institutes and designing bureaus, the first artificial Earth satellite in the world has now been created. This first satellite was today successfully launched in the USSR.
And people worldwide could listen to its beeps. In the streets, some Americans were found to express the shock.
Do you admire the Russians for doing it or not?
No, definitely not. I said we should have been the first ones to have it, if there's such thing.
It gets the American people alarmed that a foreign country, especially an enemy country, can do this.
Definitely alarmed.
What do you think about America not being able to do the same?
Well, if I was in military service and fell down on a job like that, I could stand a court-martial. Somebody's fallen down on a job, badly.
Other shocks followed. The first dog in space. The first object to hit the moon. Then came this.
Today, the 12th of April, 1961, the first cosmic spaceship named Vostok, with a man on board, was orbited round the Earth from the Soviet Union. He is Airman Major Yuri Gagarin, an Air Force pilot, a citizen of the Union of the Soviet Socialist Republic.
The new United States president asked his advisors what could be done to impress the world. Some advocated cancer research. Others, the detonation of a thermonuclear bomb on the moon in plain sight of the peoples of the planet. Well, John Kennedy was not interested in space.
The other thing is, I would certainly not say we're spending $6 or $7 billion to find out about space. Why are we spending $7 billion on getting fresh water from saltwater when we're spending $7 billion to find out about space? But so obviously you wouldn't put it on that priority except for the defense implications.
However, he was aware that space projects would secure world respect for the United States, so publicly became a vocal supporter of those projects that would do most to earn that respect. Here is Kennedy in conversation with NASA's administrator, James Webb.
But I'll tell you what will be accomplished while you're president, and it'll be one of the most important things that's been done in this nation. A basic means to use technology for total national power. That's going to come out of the space program more than any single thing. A basic ability in this nation to use science and very advanced technology to increase national power. Yeah, our economy all the way through.
And do you think the man landing on the moon is a good idea?
Yes, sir. I think it is. Because?
We can do the same with instruments much cheaper.
No, sir, you can't do the same.
Kennedy's predecessor, Dwight Eisenhower, had been alarmed at how much the Mercury manned space project was costing and firmly opposed NASA's plans for additional flights. There was no way NASA's ambitions for human flights to the moon would be authorized on his watch. The detailed story of how Kennedy was persuaded to advocate for the Apollo Lunar Project is not for us to tell this evening. Suffice to say that on May the 25th of 1961, he stood before Congress and made this request.
I believe that this nation should commit itself to achieving the goal before this decade is out of landing a man on the moon and returning him safely to the Earth. No single space project in this period will be more impressive to mankind or more important for the long-range exploration of space, and none will be so difficult or expensive to accomplish.
As Eisenhower had feared and Kennedy predicted, the endeavor was frightfully expensive but was accomplished on July the 21st of 1969 at 6:18 a.m. Australian Eastern Time.
Contact light. Okay, engine stop. Houston, Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
Roger, Tranquility. We copy you on the ground. You got a bunch of guys about to turn blue. We're breathing again. Thanks a lot.
6.5 hours later, Neil Armstrong stepped onto the moon.
I'm going to step off the land now. That's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Having achieved Kennedy's challenge, there were many who advocated no further flights. Why spoil this crowning glory with probable future failures, possibly deaths? NASA had plans for Apollo missions out to Apollo 20. Well, eventually, these were whittled back to Apollo 17. And so it came to pass that 50 years ago this month, the penultimate Apollo lunar landing mission set out for the moon. Apollo 16 commander was John Young, who had already orbited the moon aboard Apollo 10. His lunar module pilot was Charlie Duke, and command module pilot Ken Mattingly, both making their first spaceflight. This evening, we mark this 50th anniversary with the first of three programs devoted to Apollo 16. We have titled them Nothing So Hidden, for reasons that will become obvious at the end of our second program. All times and dates will be Australian Eastern. The programs are structured around an interview we had with Charlie Duke in 2014 in our Southern FM studios.
Welcome to the Space Show on Southern FM.
Andrew, good to be with you. Thank you so much.
Also, a lecture recording we made in Canberra in 1994 of John Young, and the in-flight press conference the trio gave during their return flight to Earth. Additionally, in our third program, we have a chat with local historian Eric Jones about his Apollo Lunar Surface Journal. Along the way, we will pop in a few snatches of mission audio and some moon song snippets.
Fly me to the moon and let me play among the stars. See what spring is like on Jupiter and Mars.
Apollo 16 was launched on 1972 April the 17th at 3:54 a.m. Well, most Australians slept. In Florida, it was 12:54 p.m. Being a Sunday, large crowds gathered in sunny conditions. Among them was King Hussein of Jordan.
I would like to take you with me on a voyage to the moon just to give everybody a feel of how it all works. The way you get to the moon is you have to climb on a large rocket. This is such a rocket, the Saturn V. There you go, 110 meters long. These were powerful rockets. They're giants. The noise that they made when it went off was awesome. Shake buildings 3 miles away. The smoke was very all over the place. It's just terrifying. And on top of this particular one, there are three very nervous human beings. Charlie Duke, Ken Mattingly, and me. And we were on our way to the moon on Apollo 16.
At 3,185 tons, this was the heaviest Saturn V to date. This was to be the fifth human landing on the moon and the eighth Apollo mission to the vicinity of the moon. Charlie Duke gave us a potted history. Now let's move on towards the flights of Apollo 8, 9, 10, well, 7, of course, and 11. What were you doing during those times?
I was monitoring during Apollo 7, 8, and 9. I was monitoring the engines and still going to Marshall. And then I got put on the support crew for Apollo 10. And my job was to be on the team that developed the lunar module activation and checkout procedures and the descent procedures for activation, checkout, and landing for the Apollo 10. Now there wasn't any landing, but we developed those procedures to take you down to landing, and the procedures to abort that and back into orbit. And so it was a very dynamic time, and it was, if you remember, the flights were going off like every 2 months. Mm. And so we had to be real quick with the procedures and real quick with the implementation of the changes, if you will, that the crew would like in the simulator. And as a result of support crew, and that being that involved, I also got put on the mission control team as CAPCOM. Generally, that didn't happen. The support crew did that, and then was somebody else was in mission control, an astronaut always, but somebody else that wasn't so intimately involved. But they said, look, why don't you do this? You develop the procedures with your team. You know them all. You're really familiar with them, and we want you in mission control. So I went on Gene Kranz's team for that activation checkout part of the mission and was there in mission control for Apollo 10. And as we activated the lunar module and started to descent just like we had trained and developed. And then that was a prelude. And if that mission went well, that it meant the next mission we were going to attempt the landing. And we actually had three crews in training for landing, Apollo 11, 12, and 13, not knowing which one would actually get it done, but they were all in training. So as a result of Apollo 10 going so well, the mission control team just shifted over, and I did the same thing on Apollo 11. Developed all those. There was just a few changes, but there were some, and we did the changes to those procedures and the landing attitudes and all of that we worked out. And so I was in mission control for the landing on Apollo 11, which was a great honor for me, and I was really humbled that I had a chance to be involved in so intimately in that historic mission especially from the mission control side.
And Duke explained when he learned of his assignment to the crew of Apollo 16. Now, after 11, there was 12 which landed, 13 which didn't make it, 14, 15, mm-hmm. and you were on 16.
That's correct, yeah.
And at what time during that process did you learn that you were on that mission?
Well, right after Apollo 11, and we had a pilot's meeting. It was sometime early August. And Deke Slayton announced the next cruise after Apollo, let's see, I think Apollo 13 was already training, but they didn't have a backup. In some way, I don't remember exactly how it occurred, but in August of 69, I found out I was going to be on backup crew for Apollo 13. And I was to be the lunar module pilot, so I was going to back up Fred Hayes. And the rotation we had back then, if you were back up on 13, you would fly on 16. If you were back up on 14, you would fly 17. And so, and I knew that if I did my job and learned the systems and didn't foul up, I was going to land on the moon on Apollo 16 if the schedule continued, and if there were a lot of ifs, but at least I'd have a chance. And so that's what happened. Right after Apollo 13 flew and we recovered them safely, the crews were announced that we would be training for Apollo 16. And eventually our landing was scheduled for sometime in 1971, but they kept extending the program. They said, well, we want a J mission, which meant a long-duration lunar module. We want to get a rover, a car on board. And so all of that stretched out the schedule. And John and I ended up training for 2 years. We originally were going to be the first flight with the car, the rover. But then they canceled the last two or three missions on Apollo, and they moved the car up one, Apollo 15. So Dave Scott and Jim Irwin got to ride it first. But John and I were in the major development of it. We followed the from the very beginning, thinking we were going to be the prime first users.
On their return trip to Earth, the three astronauts were asked about the multiple problems they experienced during their mission.
Question 6. You've had a lot of equipment trouble during this mission. Is there a common thread running through all these problems for which you could suggest an explanation?
I think spaceflight's kind of complicated. You've got a lot of sophisticated equipment here that you're trying to get to all work at one time. I think that's what we built the redundancy in for, and it seems to be paying off quite well.
Yeah, I don't think there's any relation between any of these failures one to another. I don't think there's any common thread. I agree with Ken. It's a very complicated gear. It has to run for long periods of time, and you've got to expect sometimes that it won't run, and you've got to know how to fix it. And that's why they send us on these trips.
And John Young had this recollection when asked in Canberra.
Now, what kind of mission did we have? Well, we had more than 100 problems on that mission. We solved them in real time. One problem we had, the engine in the command and service module Casper wasn't working very well, so we had to redo it and get it checked all over the United States to make sure it worked right, and we were delayed 6 hours landing on the moon. And we solved about 99 other problems with us and the people in mission control and us working separately on the lunar surface sometime to solve those problems. And that mission really was a microcosm of what life is all about, solving problems in real time, working in teamwork with your friends, and getting things done. And I was very proud of the performance that people made on that mission because we learned a lot.
More about Apollo 16 coming up.
On FM, online, and on TuneIn, 24/7. This is 88.3 Southern FM.
I want to go dancing on the moon. I want to frolic in zero gravity. Hear Jupiter sing to herself. Saturn's rings, when will space be open for me? I wanna go dancing on the moon.
At 6:11 on Wednesday morning, 74 hours after leaving Earth, Apollo 16 passed out of sight around the moon's west limb. 11 minutes later, the service propulsion engine burnt for 6 minutes, slowing Apollo 16 into lunar orbit. Now, Perilloon, the low point, was 107 kilometres and Apolloon was 315 kilometres. Each orbit lasted about 2 hours. At the end of the second revolution, the orbit was lowered to Perilloon of 20 kilometres and Apolloon of 108 kilometres. Apollo 16 would stay in that orbit until the command service module and the lunar module undocked on Revolution 12. Undocking was successful, but problems had developed in the service propulsion system engine. The descent to the surface by the lunar module was always initiated on the lunar far side. In the face of this serious problem, Young and Duke remained formation flying with Mattingly. It looked like Apollo 16 would have to return to Earth without the landing. Engineers on Earth worked frantically to come up with a solution. At most, the landing could be delayed by 5 revolutions, or 10 hours, before the landing would have to be abandoned. After frantic ground tests and earnest debate in mission control, shortly before the 2 spacecraft appeared in Revolution 15, the decision was made to go for a landing attempt on Revolution 16. The lunar module, using call sign Orion, entered its descent orbit when behind the moon and began its powered descent at an altitude of 20 kilometres as it approached its Descartes landing site. At any point during the descent, John Young could have aborted the landing. I asked Charlie Duke about this.
How low could you have gotten before you, in order to still be able to abort?
Well, you can abort 2 feet off the moon. Right. If, in fact, we had the lunar module would land on a 10-degree slope, and you could land, and if you landed slow enough at a low rate of descent, it would be stable on a 10-degree slope. Be very difficult to work around that, but it would. But if you landed real hard and it hit that slope, it would turn over. Mm-hmm. And in simulation, we did a lot of turnovers. And if you caught it fast enough, you could hit the abort stage and it would fire the engine and you'd get off. So you could be on the moon and abort. But the idea was if you were several thousand feet up and you developed this problem and mission control called an abort, then you'd throttle up to maximum power and you'd start a positive rate of climb. And so that was the idea. To leave 4% fuel or thereabouts, so if you had an abort low down, he could throttle up, get a positive rate of climb, and then abort stage, and then the ascent engine would take you back into orbit.
I also asked Duke about the landing. At what point during the descent and landing did you think, we've got it done?
I felt like it was an altitude, probably about 2,000 meters. The vehicle, you're looking out towards space, and you can't see the moon, but your radar altimeter and all your computer's giving you altitude. And at about 2,000 meters, it pitches down, and you can see the moon for the first time. And we were right on target. I recognized 2 big craters that were in our landing site. And I said, we got it made. At that point, I said, we got it made, John. And we started maneuvering, and I was monitoring the systems. John was taking over and flying the vehicle. and I was basically talking him down, you know, giving him altitude, giving him rate of descent, giving him lateral velocity, forward velocity, so that about 60, 80 feet, he'd picked out a landing spot, and I'm talking him down slowly and occasionally looking out my side, make sure there's no rock or a hole, a crater that one of the legs could land in on my side that he couldn't see. And, man, we touched down and engine stopped, and we were dead level. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was a perfect landing spot. And then I got the shock of my life. Well, not quite, but a real shock. Later on, when we first EVA, the Apollo experiments package was on the backside of the lunar module in the third quadrant on the back. And so it was my job to get it off, get the RTG, the power source, off, which was also back there. And I walked back there and I said, "Look at this, John." And we had missed a big crater by like 6 feet. Wow. And 2 meters. And if we'd have landed 6 feet back, we'd have been, we wouldn't have turned over, but it would have been a very awkward attitude to work around. Mm. It might have even put the experiments package out of my reach, because I'd have been down in this hole. And we hadn't even seen it. It was a shallow enough crater that it didn't have any shadows, but not so deep that you could see it.
Yes, because you landed in a lunar morning and the sun angle was quite critical.
It was, because we wanted those shadows. We wanted to see the edge of the craters. We wanted to see the blocks. We wanted to see the slope of the terrain. If the slope, surface was tilted toward you, it was bright gray. If it was tilted away from you, it was dark gray. And so we use that to give us a sort of a sense of level, if you will. We pick something that's sort of in between the dark and the light that was going to be good. And John did a great job.
Off the NASA audio loop, this is how the landing sounded to us back here on Earth.
B-64 at 8200. Pro, pitch over. Pitch over. And here it is, Gators, Lone Star.
I'll do the same, Charlie.
Okay, 40 degrees, 38 degrees.
Right.
Down that on dot, north ray. Looks like we're going to be able to make it, John. There's not too many blocks up there.
Ryan, you go
okay,
for landing.
Okay, 4,000 feet.
Go for landing.
42 LPD.
42.
Okay, 3,900 feet.
Okay, 2 to the south, Charlie.
Okay. It's in. Okay, 42, 41 LPD, 30,000 feet on profile.
Okay, there's, we're coming right down, going to be a little past,
okay, 41 LPD,
okay,
2,000 feet, 60 on profile.
Okay,
42 LPD, couple of more in, 1,400 feet, 44, down, looking good. Okay, out of 1,000 feet, right on profile. 54 LPD, dropping out the bottom now, 800 feet, 30 down.
Okay, Houston, we're going to be just a little long.
Roger.
But we're just now beam double spot.
Copy.
Okay, 23, 22 down at 500 feet. Big blocks over here to the left, John. Okay, 300 feet, 15 down.
Okay. Take over, Charlie.
Okay. Okay, fuel is good, 10%. That comes a shadow. Okay, 200 feet, 11 down. Okay, 5 down at 130 feet. 2 forward. Omaha, Richmond. Okay, looking good. Perfect place over here, John. A couple of big boulders. Not too bad. Okay, 80 feet. Down at 3, looking super. There's dust. Okay, down at 3, 50 feet. Down at 4, give me one click up. Backing up slightly. Okay, 2 down, stand by for contact. I'm going to let her down. You level off, let her on down. Okay, 76%, plenty fast. Contact, stop, boom, blow, engine arm.
Wow! Oh, man!
Blow, engine arm. He finished command over us. Okay, 430 dead. Check the app.
Now, we don't have to walk far to pick up blocks.
Okay, you got it. Okay, we're forward to the north, forward and to the north, double spot. I would guess about 200 meters to the north and maybe 150 meters.
And that touchdown came at 12:23 on Thursday afternoon, April the 21st. Despite the delayed landing, Orion was only 236 metres from its pre-flight target. In their press conference, as they were en route back to Earth, the crew were asked about the delayed landing.
Question two. When the CSM circularization burn could not be performed on schedule, did you think you wouldn't be able to land on the moon?
Yeah, I thought we all had serious doubts about whether we were going to be able to do it or not.
That four-hour delay in landing had consequences. In pre-flight planning, Young and Duke were to have made their first moonwalk soon after landing, then go to sleep. Instead, Young and Duke decided to sleep first, then moonwalk. Whilst they slept, the Earth continued to rotate on its spin axis. The moon set below the horizon as seen from the tracking station at Honeysuckle Creek in the Australian Capital Territory. The plan had been to relay the television from the moon to the Australian television channels. At the time, I was temporarily living in Sydney. In expectation of seeing the three moonwalks live from the moon, I hired a television set. But because the moon was not visible from Australia, there would be no free television from Honeysuckle Creek. None of the three networks were willing to shell out the dosh to bring the signal into Australia via the Intelsat satellites, which were quite expensive to hire. Instead of astronauts on the moon, I was able to watch three broadcasts of Eric von Daniken's film Chariots of the Gods. Yes, I kid you not, Channel 7 had this pile of rubbish on high repetition. At least, to my recollection, it was Channel 7 and not Channel 9.
In Mexico and South America, from Egypt to India, throughout the world, people have fables, legends, and even religions which center around visits from foreign astronauts. Of course, they don't call them astronauts, but gods who came to Earth in miraculous sky vehicles.
Written accounts of godlike visitors abound. For example, in the books of the Tibetan Kanshur.
The secret code of these texts is the most complex devised by man. The resulting texts, which we can now read, are full of references to gods appearing in the sky, of the luminous pearls and transparent spheres that these gods lived in. Once these books have been completely deciphered, they are bound to yield much more information about these mysterious space visitors.
Well, I was quite disappointed at not being able to see these moonwalks live. When I first met Charlie Duke in the 1990s, I told him this story, and he very kindly said that he hoped meeting him was making up for it, and it sure was. Well, back to Apollo 16. Shortly after landing and before going to sleep, the astronauts described their Descartes moonscape.
Hey, it sure ain't flat, John.
Wow.
There's that ridge to the north.
Yep, sure is.
All we got to do is jump out the hatch, and we got plenty of rock.
Houston, fly. It sure looks like you can make, I see Crown Crater from here. I can see Ray Crater from here. Charlie's about... Charlie's got nothing but a ridge to look at.
That sounds beautiful, John. Wish I were there.
There's a ridge out. There's a ridge out in front of us too, John. Yeah, there's a ridge in front of us, one to the side of us, and my guess is that we're in a subdued old crater that's got a lot more craters.
Ready, we copy.
What a neat place. Hey, Jim, this ridge in front of us does look like a subdued crater, and it maybe is a raised rim about 50 meters in front of us, about 4 or 5 meters tall. About 30 or 40% of the surface is covered with boulders that are maybe a half a meter in size. On out in front of us and to the right, where we landed, there were.
Hey, Miss Charlie, we got to stay, Houston. The way these blocks are laid in here out my window, I guess they come from South Ray. There's some biggies out there. We've got right out in front of us about 100 meters at my 10:30 position. I've got one that must be 3 meters across.
Orion, you're safe for T1.
Hey, Jim, that's off in a case of beer to Fido. I'll tell you, that targeting was just beautiful. Boy, you guys just started us right in there. That was superb.
Very good.
Where it says we are, I believe it. Boy, this is really a nice place. You like 1/6 G, Charlie.
My restraint harness has got me anchored.
Oh, that's what the trouble is.
It's about level. We're not going to have a bit of trouble getting it.
No, it's going to be neat. But it sure is not. It's not that FS smooth. We're in the middle of a block deal.
Right.
There's a Crown Crater up there. But they're little blocks. And, Jim, we got Crown Crater out John's left window about 9 o'clock. And just looking at it from here, I don't think the rover's going to have any trouble going up that hill.
Glad to hear that.
Could be wrong. Slopes tend to fool you. It looked good going north right, too. There was some big blocks on the rim, but not, the track just looked good.
Looked good, huh?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Like we're right on top of the ground. Yeah, we dropped very far. Yeah, we got a lot of rocks, that's for sure. I wish I could tell you what kind of rocks those are, Houston, but some of them are very white. Doggone if I can see. I'm not close enough to them, but... I see one white one with some black. Can't tell whether that's dirt or not on it. But it could be a white breccia.
We copy.
Every one of them are angular, too, John. Yeah, they're all angular. They're out of South Ray, I believe.
In Canberra, John Young was asked how the Descartes landing site was selected. Now, Young was a man of few words, but he could tell a good joke.
The problem is that he landed on the moon determined.
How was the spot at which we landed on the moon determined? Boy, they have a thing called the Lunar and Planetary Science Working Group, that Lunar Science Working Group that decided this, and it was about, I'd say, 25 or 30 scientists who would sit in a room, locked in this room, and the one that came out would determine where we landed. No. That's not so, but it was almost like that, because there's so many exciting places to land on the moon that they did have vigorous discussions, heated arguments. I don't think they ever came to blows, but they sure were mad about it, and everybody had a reason why they wanted to land this, that, and the other place. The reason they picked Descartes, because it was in the highlands and nobody had ever been there, and the rock types they thought were good. And there were three or four other places we could have landed. They wanted us to go to Mary's Hills, which had an old volcanic, had a relatively new volcanic complex up there. They wanted us to land in Alphonsus, where the Ranger landed, which had brand new volcanic craters in there. And there were some people who wanted us to land on the backside of the moon so they wouldn't have to be bothered with us at all. And that is a fact. But they did have a lot. They did have a lot of friction and fighting over selecting landing sites. They did.
Two significant landmarks near the landing site were North Ray and South Ray craters. Young had this description of South Ray crater.
And landing on the moon, that's possible too. We did land on the moon, and Charlie looked out our window and he said, "Hey, John," he says, "you've landed right on top of South Ray crater." South Ray crater is actually to the southeast of the lunar module, and it's about 8.5 kilometers away. I said, "Charlie, we didn't land on South Ray crater. You're wrong again." And what it was why he thought that, you know why he thought that? It's because there are no telegraph poles up there to tell how far away things are. No telegraph poles up there yet.
More about Apollo 16 coming up.
88.3 Southern FM, the sounds of the Bayside.
Giant steps are what you take, walking on the moon. I hope my leg don't break, walking on the moon.
In all, Young and Duke made 3 moonwalks. Here is what Charlie Duke said as he first stepped onto the moon.
Tommy.
we're making little footprints here about half-inch deep. Not kicking up really very much.
One of the tasks was to set up a clutch of scientific instruments that would continue to operate after they departed for Earth. These were collectively known as the Apollo Lunar Science Experiments Package. Here's John Young.
We put out a lunar science station up there on the moon. That jobber in the back with the black coating around it is a radioactive thermal generator. It sent information back to Earth for 5 years after Charlie and I left up there. Going out up there to that side of the picture is a magnetometer. We discovered that the moon has a magnetic field, an ancient magnetic field that we didn't expect to see. In the foreground is a device called a seismometer. It measures moonquakes and moon impacts. A moonquake is something you can sit in this auditorium forever and never even feel. A moon impact is something else again. They found out from moon impacts that excited this seismometer that maybe the moon has a molten core. We learned that from it. And we measured 2,500 moon impacts a year with that seismometer right there. The principal investigator who taught us how to put that seismometer up, he told us, he says, if you don't put my seismometer up right, he says, don't come back. That's my kind of guy. And that was the most sensitive seismometer that was on the moon, probably because of what he told us.
A separate instrument was an ultraviolet camera, a telescope camera.
We put the first telescope that's ever been on the moon up there on our mission. It's a beautiful thing. It took these pictures right here. This is a computer, ultraviolet computer-enhanced picture of planet Earth. Across the middle of it are those blue equatorial air blow belts, and then down at the south there is aurora. It says there's a lot of ultraviolet, oxygen-rich molecules floating around in space. People used to think the oxygen created those molecules, helped life on Earth get its start, but we know now that's not so. What it does tell you from looking at a telescope picture from the moon is that when the seasons vary, you can look at the poles from the moon 24 hours a day, and you can see any spot on the equator for 12 hours a day. One of these days, I feel sure that telescopes on the moon will help us keep a better eye on planet Earth.
And Young himself also took time to look at the Earth.
When you get to the moon, you look back and you're 300,000 kilometers from home. And there's planet Earth. And that's about what you see when you look back from the moon to the Earth. You see the white of the clouds and the blue of the oceans, and it's very difficult to see continents. And when you see something that far away and you're traveling around the moon, if that doesn't make you nervous, then you probably don't ever have to worry about being nervous again. Flying around the moon is very delightful. It's unusual because it's not like flying around the Earth at all. Flyers, as you know, claim they know all this and know all that about flying around the Earth, but most of the time people who fly airplanes are lost about half the time. We'd never admit it, never. But flying around the moon is a totally different matter. There are no clouds, there are no oceans to fly over. You just look down and you can see a crater just like you see there, that little bright red crater in the foreground. It's just beautiful. And that big crater back there, Theophilus, there's no other craters like that on the whole moon. So if you know those craters, and they're all different, you know exactly where you are on the moon the whole time. I just tell you this so when you young people start navigating up there, you don't get worried and disoriented like us old pilots do here on Earth.
For all of the Apollo moon flights, the astronauts were trained in geology, so they could identify which samples to bring back to Earth. I asked Charlie Duke about this. Now, during your astronaut training, any highlights stand out?
Well, I enjoyed geology. None of us had any experience in geology except for Jack Schmidt, who ended up flying on Apollo 17, he had a PhD in geology. So he was basically one of our instructors. But we had a group of instructors from all over the United States who were tops in their field of in field geology, volcanic, sedimentary rock, igneous rocks. And I really enjoyed the geology training because it got you out of the office. You were out in the field for 3 days a month and, you know, walking and seeing this magnificent parts of the U.S. and Hawaii. And so it was geology training I really enjoyed.
Were you with Eugene Shoemaker at any time?
We were. He was one of our prime instructors, and he didn't go on every geology trip, but he was there a lot, and he was also one of our prime instructors in classroom work in geology. The primary guys were people from the United States Geological Service had a lunar laboratory up in Flagstaff, Arizona, and we worked with them a lot. And Lee Silver was another from Caltech, a very famous geologist. He's still alive. The other was Bill Mulberger, who was turned out to be the head of our science team. He was from the University of Texas and head of the Department of Geology. He passed away a couple of years ago. But they became lifelong friends. We were so close in training. And, 6 years with them. And so it was a really very special.
During their moonwalks, the astronauts made some significant discoveries.
In the foreground, Charlie and I found some very old rocks. One of them was age-dated in 1987 at 4.5 billion years old. That's very old. You don't find rocks on Earth that old. The moon is telling us about our lost youth here on Earth.
And this question at the mid-flight press conference.
Question number 3 in 3 parts. Were you surprised at the rocks and other formations at the Cayley site?
I think we were. The original impression had been mostly volcanics to look for. And I don't think we found the highest percentage of volcanics as we had originally anticipated. So the rocks that we found were unique, that we had never seen before in any of the lunar samples, we feel. And so it was a surprise.
Do you think your geological training properly prepared you to describe them?
I think so, under the circumstances. You see, most of the rocks are were dust-covered, apparently, by the two impacts, North Ray and South Ray. It just thrown a big blanket of dust out across there, and we saw very few rocks that were clean until we cut into them. And you don't want to take too much time to stop and whack off a piece of rock, because that's pretty hard to do in a pressure suit. So we're just describing them more by shape and softness and friability and things like that. And that really doesn't take a lot of training, but I think we've had adequate training to do this kind of job.
Did you see anything specifically volcanic?
As far as craters go, Hank, we think we saw two that have the shape, we called endogenic, that have the shape of very subdued old cinder cones or something of that nature. They were, in other words, they were looked more like, sinkholes, really, with the surrounding topography. They had no rim on them. To us, it looked like it might have been a source for some a volcanic activity way, way back.
We learned a very great deal from that mission, and we're still learning. People are still working on those good old rocks.
Both astronauts made standing jumps when photographing each other, saluting the United States flag.
Question number 9 for John and Charlie. At the tag end of EVA 3, you appeared to be having a high jump competition. Who won, and how high do you think you jumped?
No, we weren't having a competition. We were just showing you some of the things you could do with a 360-pound mass
It only weighs 60 pounds, even slowed down, if you will, by the pressure suit. And I don't think anybody won. We were just demonstrating what you can do in the suit. Any idea how high we jumped? You have to look at the TV, maybe a foot or 2 feet. It was too high for me.
The photographs of the seemingly levitated astronauts amused Young's Canberra audience.
We did get out on the lunar surface, and we practiced in Earth, back on the Earth, 7-8 hours at a clip, deploying the lunar science station and picking up rocks on the surface wearing this same pressure suit. Well, the pressure suit and I on Earth weighed about 155 kilograms. On the moon, you could jump. You couldn't even lift your big toe on Earth. On the moon, you could jump meter flat-footed off the ground. You could pick up the equivalent of 40 kilograms of Earth rocks in your hands and jump 2 meters up to the second rung of the lunar ladder and go right in without any problems at all.
Most lunar craters are meteorite impacts, not volcanic. Many are shallow with gentle slopes, but there are exceptions, such as the one nicknamed Plum Crater. This is 40 metres in diameter and 10 metres deep and has very steep slopes. The astronauts had been reluctant to go close to it.
Question 4. Several times at North Ray you mentioned don't get too close to the edge. Did you think that if you had fallen in, you wouldn't have been able to get out?
That's affirmative. You bet if we had fallen in, we would not have been able to get out. That's correct.
Well, this is our first of three programs about the Apollo 16 mission to the moon. Now, there aren't many songs about Apollo 16. In fact, there's only one that I could find. There's lots of electronic-y type music about Apollo 16, but here's one which I've been able to find about Apollo 16.
Apollo 16, coming straight from the moon. If you want to get it, you check me at this studio where you get the broom to sweep the room. Leave it up. Song was in heaven. Apollo 8, you guys wait at the gate for fate. Apollo 9, you guys climb aside with say the ladder. Leave it up. Apollo 10, 5 and 5 make 10. You guys grab a girl and take a fire friend. Leave it up and that would deliver the child. Dig it up and that would tell the truth. Wind it up and that would leave it up to you. Take a time and that would tell you why the line. Take a time, take a time, take a time.
This has been The Space Show. I'm Andrew Rennie. We'll be back next week with episode 2 of our Nothing So Hidden series.